the high desert in the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in the world's time zones. I'm Art Bell, and this is Midnight in the Desert. All right, it's going to be a different kind of night tonight, although we have a guest coming on that's going to knock your socks off. I know he does mine. Joseph McGonigal is here tonight, and he really is the nation's premier, and I mean premier, remote viewer. It's going to be a fascinating night, I guarantee you. Rules of the show are simple. No bad language and only one call per show. That's it. Two rules. No bad language, one call per show. People thank quite a few. Telos for the great sound. It is amazing sound. Joe Talbot at Telos, thank you. Keith Rowland, my webmaster. He'll be up next for a reason that I'll explain in a moment. My producer, Heather Wade. All of you, the Bell Gab people. The Bell Gab inhabitants. People love our Bell and the Midnight in Desert sites. Stream guys, who get it to you? LV.net, who gets it to them? Our sales guy, Peter Eberhardt. If you want to advertise, he's your guy, Peter Eberhardt. And boy, do your commercials get heard. But first, tonight, we are going to do something that needs to be done. Well, we've already done something that needs to be done. People screamed at us, oh, get us an RSS feed. I didn't even know what an RSS feed was. I still am a little foggy on the subject. If you own an Apple product, it's really easy. If you own an Android product, it's still pretty easy. What it does, it's one application sits on your phone or your iPad or something or another, and my shows just show up on it. And by the way, they're 1 hour each now instead of in three parts. Already converted the ones in there, too. But the whole RSS thing is really hard to explain. So I am bringing my webmaster, my old friend of 5,000 years, Keith Rowland, on the air to tell you what we have done and how to get involved with it. Keith?
Hello there. Good evening.
Welcome to the program.
Here I am. First time for me.
It is a first time. Great. All right. So we have this going, right?
We do. We rushed it together here over the weekend and have this thing up and running. We hope it's going to last and work and continue, but just beware. We're kind of testing on the fly, which is what we do around here.
I feel the same way about myself.
Yeah. Let's just put it out there and see where it breaks.
I mean, that'll keep going.
Yep.
Go ahead. Tell them what we've got.
Okay, well, the 22nd precursor to what we have is RSS stands for Really Simple Syndication. At least that's what it did when it first started. It's changed. Back in 1999, thereabouts, or a little bit earlier than that, this was a protocol that allowed you to kind of get a list every day of what's new on a website. So you could have a news reader or some kind of a reading program. Boom, get all the headlines and pick what you want to read without having to go through the website all on your own. So essentially content was pushed down to you, to your program. And so every day you could get those listings and so on. And then shortly afterwards, a man named Dave Weiner took on a task that Adam Curry asked for, and everybody should know Adam Curry, maybe, way back from MTV or VH1 days. Anyway,
right.
He wanted to be able to have his podcast audio file attached to these RSS feeds. So instead of it just being news stories and blog posts, you could actually send down a link to an audio file. So Dave added on what's called MP3 enclosures, and you could attach things to it. So now this functionality of adding an MP3 audio enclosure to this RSS feed is now what podcast players use to get the listing of files to download, get the listing of the daily updates and what's new, and download it to your podcast player. And so once you sign up or subscribe, they call it subscribing, to an RSS feed, not to be confused with subscribing to the Time Travelers, but it's sort of the kind of thing you sign up for it.
If you're a time traveler, you already are entitled to the RSS feed, right?
That's correct. The RSS feed link will only be available on the archive page of the Time Traveler section of the website. So if you're already logging in, you already get the list of files that you've been looking at already. There's now a link at the top of that page called RSS feed link for podcast players.
Okay, what do you do with that link?
Well, depending on which particular application or a phone that you have.
Let's do one at a time, Keith. Say I'm an Apple guy, which I am, and I want to have this newfangled thing. I go to artbell.com, and then I go where and do what?
Well, you're going to get over to the Dark Matter Digital Network Archive Time Traveler area. So everybody's that wants this already knows kind of how to do that. They're already signed up. They go there every day.
All right, they want to do this with Safari, right?
Right. On the iOS devices, the Safari browser is the easiest one. So if you're using Chrome, it doesn't quite work this way. So initially, you only have to do this one time to get started, and then it's automatic after that. So, again, it's inside the archived area under the Time Traveler area. This is not free for everybody. It's just another way of getting the files much easier than we had previously working. So you go to your Safari browser, you go to the page, you log in, and you go to the archive page with all the Midnight in the Desert files at. And at the top of that page, there is a link there. And so you will click on that link, and it will then go off to another server that we had to put up together this weekend. So it's going to ask you for your username password again. And this, again, we just have to do this one time. And then once it does that, Safari will then go and launch the podcast player inside your iPhone or iPad, the Apple podcast player. And it will pass along to it the name of that podcast that you want to subscribe to.
All right, brief little thing. After you've clicked on the link, put in your password and everything, it may or may not automatically launch your podcast player. So if it doesn't, just go to your podcast player after you put your password in, and it'll be alive.
Correct. But it should launch it because it's got to pass that URL. If not, you just right-click that URL, and you can put it in there manually in the podcast player, too. But we're hoping that this will just jump right over there automatically, which would be kind of cool. And then when the podcast player runs and it says, okay, I'm going to go subscribe to Midnight in the Desert RSS feed, it's going to ask you for your username password again.
And you're going to be saying bad words by then.
Yep. But again, this is only the one time you have to do that.
Okay.
So then once you enter it in, it'll say, do you want to subscribe? Yes. What's your username password? Da-da-da-da-da. Okay. Then give it about 5-10 seconds, because now it's going off and going to grab a list of all the files that are in the RSS feed.
So all the shows that we've done.
The shows, right.
Yes.
It's gonna go back to the website. It's gonna get a list of the shows. It's gonna download it into your iPhone, iPad, and it'll give you a new entry for a new RSS subscription, podcast subscription on the left-hand column. And then it will start listing the individual episodes in the right-hand column. Mm-hmm. And usually by default, the first time you put in a new podcast that you want to listen to, it'll go ahead and download the first episode. So that may happen automatically. Now, if you've used this podcast player on your iPhone, iPad for other things in the past, this is just going to add to the list. It's just going to put it in the list at the top or the bottom of your list. I forget which it is. And it'll just add it to what you already have. And whatever your settings are, the same settings will apply. Because you can do things like, how many episodes do you want to list? How many mm-hmm. episodes do you want to automatically download? How often do you want to check for new episodes? A lot of little tweakers you can do. I'll leave that to the user to figure out
what is
their best way.
It is incredibly cool. I know it sounds kind of complicated when Keith talks about it, but it's not. And once you've done it, it is so cool. It is so cool. Trust me on this. All right. Now, if you're not an Apple user, that was good for all the Apple people.
Yep.
Next comes Android.
Yes, Android, since Android has a variety of browsers, has a variety of podcast players, they don't really have a default one. So if you're browsing around in Chrome and you find a link and you click it, it's just not going to automatically go to some Android podcast player. You get to pick which one you would like. We have one that we've tested that we think is the best one to start with. You might like something better later.
So you're about to get the name of an app to use with Android. Listen carefully. It is
called Beyond Pod.
Beyond Pod. So if they go to their toy store or whatever they call it.
Yeah, the Play Store.
Androidville.
Yep.
They'll be able to find that easily, and it's free, right?
Yes. So there's only some podcast players allow you to put in username passwords, and some don't. Remember, podcasts used to be free for years and years. It's only been in the last few years that we started getting these paid podcasts that take mm-hmm. usernames and passwords. So there's tons of podcast apps out there that won't work because they're just not equipped to deal with username passwords. So you got to get one that does that. This is one of the ones that does that.
And again, the name?
Beyond Pod.
Beyond Pod. Okay, great. Now, once you get it,
I'll have a little help page up later on the website to have all these links and stuff.
Nevertheless, once you get that, what do you do?
Well, you're going to download that app and install it, and then you're going to go to whatever browser you were using to surf our web currently. Again, logging in, go to the archive page where you list all of our shows. You got that link at the top again, same one, RSS feed link for podcast players.
Right.
And this time, instead of clicking on it, you're going to want to copy that link to go back to the podcast app and put it in there. So I think you touch and hold the link, and then you'll get an option to copy the link. And then you can then switch over to the Beyond Pod application and then go into adding a new subscription, adding a new podcast. Then it will ask you, well, what's the URL? You're going to paste this link into it, and then it should take off like everything else. It'll go and access it. It'll ask you for a username and password, should download it, give you a list of files, and you're off and running.
I've never been to copy and paste school.
I know. On a phone, it's a lot it's trickier than on a computer. Yeah. There's no right click. You even notice that?
Right. So you hold your finger down.
I know.
Okay. So. All right. So that gets it going then on Android. Anything else?
Even on a regular computer, iTunes supports this. You can just go into your iTunes, and one of the options, menu options, is subscribe to podcast. And you click on that, and you just paste in that same URL, and it'll join and ask you for the password, and off and running on your Mac, or even, I think, you know, iTunes on Windows.
All right. So. Well, we had hundreds of people begging for this, so here it is, and we have somebody we should thank publicly, I think, on the air, and that is Keith?
Mr. Sam Bosell.
Sam Bosell from Bellgap.
Yep. He started this as his own little personal project, and we got wind of it, and we hooked up and decided to make it official. And so we got him to move his stuff over to our servers, and we spent the weekend working out all the little details so that we could launch this thing today.
Working your butts off, really.
I'm sorry?
Working your butts off, really.
Well, it was a long day, that's for sure.
All right, so that's how you do it for Apple. That's how you do it for Android. And once you've done it, let me tell you, folks, you'll be happy as a clam, Keith. It was wonderful having you on the air. We almost never hear you on the air, so it's great having you.
I'll go crawl back behind the desk now.
Well, thank you for being my webmaster all these years.
Yes, it's turned out to be over 20. So... You keep asking, but I think somewhere in the 94,
I really didn't 95. Want an. Actually, I didn't want an answer, Keith.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Over 20. All right, all right. You got it. Thank you, buddy.
All right. See you later.
That's it, folks. That's how you do it. Joe McMonagle is coming up next. Oh, what a program I've got for you tonight. This is going to be good stuff. Radio Gold. Don't go anywhere.
Strike 12, and Midnight in the Desert is pounding packets your way on the Dark Matter Digital Network. To call the show, please direct your finger digits to dial 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
All right, what a treat you're in for. Joe McMonagle is currently a full-time research associate and partner with the Laboratories for Fundamental Research, Cognitive Sciences Laboratory, Palo Alto, California, where he has provided consulting support to research and development in remote viewing for 21 years. As a consultant to both SRI International and Science Applications International Corporation, Inc., 84 to 95, he's participated in protocol design, statistical information collection, R&D evaluations, as well as hundreds of remote viewing trials in support of experimental research an active intelligence operations for what is now known as Project Stargate. He is well-versed with developmental theory, methods of application, current training technologies for remote viewing as currently applied under strict lab controls. He is also a full member of the Parapsychological Association with a career spanning 38 years. He has provided professional support to, get this, the Secret Service, CIA, NSA, DEA, FBI, Defense Intelligence Agency, United States Customs, National Security Council, most major command within the Department of Defense. 20 of those years have been within paranormal operations as viewer number, get this, 001 and 372. Joe McMonagle, welcome to the program.
Hi, Art. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm really well, thank you, and really happy to be talking to you because this is truly fascinating stuff. Now, there are many remote viewers in the land, and for years I did interview one who predicted extremely catastrophic things that have not yet, thankfully, occurred. And and he also promised that he was going to find gold. This is what really irritates me. Find gold and bring it to me. The gold never showed. The catastrophes never happened. I know you're in a completely different category, Joe, so I just wanted to say that.
Well, I appreciate that, Art. Thank you.
So I want to start by knowing, because this really does interest me, how long have you been a remote viewer? And when I ask who you work for, you're going to rattle off all those three letter agencies. But go right ahead.
Okay, I've been doing remote viewing now for a little over 37 years, not quite 38 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't re-mention those same acronyms. I'll save the people listening, but some of the things you left out was the Secret Service. Of course, you did cover the labs, and I've also done remote viewing for major television networks in seven different countries and dozens of sheriff, state, and city police forces, private detective agencies, a multitude of major corporations, and of course, hundreds of private citizens.
I can't resist. You say you worked with the NSA.
Right.
And the Secret Service. Now, I have had some dealings with the Secret Service, because every time somebody predicts that a president will get assassinated, two Secret Service guys come to see me. And I've noted that these guys absolutely have no sense of humor whatsoever. Way with the NSA? You know, other agencies?
Well, maybe. It depends on what the subject matter is. In terms of the Secret Service, their primary job, their only job, is, of course, protecting the President of the United States. So they take even the most ridiculous threat very, very seriously. And that's why they come and see you, and that's why they will continue to come and see you probably whenever somebody makes that kind of a statement or something on the air.
I don't let that be said anymore, Joe, for that exact reason. I mean, they come and they sit on the couch, and I say, you know, it's a little old lady in Missouri. She didn't mean it, really. We don't even know who she is. And, you know, then I'll say something funny. They don't even crack a smile.
No, because it's not, it's not a funny issue with them.
Right.
They get literally hundreds of threats, I'm sure, on an annual basis, and they have to check every single one of them out, because if they don't check one of them out and it turns out to be real, then, you know, it's a serious situation. So,
trust me, they're so serious, Joe, that I feel like throwing my hands up and saying, hands up, don't shoot.
But it's almost as serious with the FBI. The FBI also takes their responsibilities very serious because they of course are required to protect us against terrorism within the United States, and of course we're not going to be subject to most of the stuff going on outside the United States, which is the CIA. So the FBI takes it very seriously as well. NSA does as well, and I would add that it's sort of a crapshoot when you start thinking about are you for or again what the NSA does. The NSA really is attempting to protect the American citizens, but there's a lot of things that they do where they can see the justification for it. No one else can. So
how do you feel about that?
Squirrely.
Yeah, how do you feel about that? Personally?
Well, I personally don't have anything to hide in my phone conversations, and I've always assumed that my phones are public property, that people can tap my phones anytime they want, and that sort of thing.
And probably
I'm a ham operator as well. So
oh, you are?
Yeah. So talking over the air is you just assume that there are a lot of people listening to what you're saying. It's the same thing with the phone. If I'm going to do something that's very private, I'm certainly not going to use a phone for it. That sort of thing. So
you worked with just about every humorless agency there is. I'm wondering, how did they find you, Joe? How did they come? I'm sure in every case they came to you, right?
Yeah. What happened is when they first decided they were going to pursue this idea of remote viewing, it initially was supposed to be a study project that was going to last approximately 3 years, and they were going to find and recruit counterintelligence people and that sort of thing, and teach us to be remote viewers if they couldn't find somebody that could remote view. And then the way they did that was kind of strange, because they knew if they brought us into a room and said, everybody who thinks they're psychic, raise your hand, we'd all just stand there and stare at each other. So they were able, though. They went through the records, and they found people who basically were exceptional in the jobs that they really shouldn't have been exceptional in, and decided that they were either extremely lucky in most cases, or were probably psychic to some degree. And once they identified those people, I being one of them, they brought us in and asked for volunteers to be tested.
Do you know how they actually got onto you? I mean, was there a website that said Psychic McMonagle or something? How did they get to you?
They actually talked to my bosses, and most of my bosses said, yeah, he's a little strange. He seems to know the answer when a lot of people don't. So right. So what they did is they called me in, and they laid a lot of psychic stuff on a table in front of me and asked me if I thought any of that stuff was real. And I told them that I needed to review it before I could make an astute comment on it. And so they gave me a couple hours to look over a lot of the material, at the end of which I said that I felt that a lot of it was bogus, but some of it seemed to be serious enough that it could pose a threat. And if it could pose a threat, then it needed to be investigated. And they thought that was a straightforward answer, so I got recruited.
Huh. Can you talk about the kind of stuff that they were asking you to evaluate?
Yeah, it's a mix of things. A lot of it was classified material that had been collected during the Cold War from the Soviet Union and China and other places. Much of it was classified, and mixed in with that were all kinds of newspaper articles, magazine articles, things that were not classified. Much of that was pretty much garbage. So they had a true mixture from the bottom of the pile to the top, and I would say maybe 15% of it was truly research, and the rest was just bogus storytelling or mythology.
Okay.
After saying all the right answers, I had an interview with Dr. Hal Putoff and Russell Targ
from
Stanford Research Institute. And as a result of that interview, they requested that the Army send me out to be tested. And so I went out and did a series of six remote viewings. And my remote viewings turned out to be, I had a p-value of 0.003, which was the best that they had seen.
Wow.
I had four near-perfect responses and two second-place responses. So before I got back to the unit, I was volunteered by the general. So that's how I got in the unit.
Okay. Give me an idea of something that you remote viewed, just so I get an idea of what in that test is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the six remote, I had never heard of remote viewing before.
Right.
And so what they did is my first remote viewing was the Stanford Art Museum at the university. And I didn't know that, of course, but they took me into a windowless room and we sat for an hour while someone I had never met I had randomly pulled a envelope from a safe and went out and drove around for a half an hour and then opened the envelope, and it told them to go to the art museum.
Okay, John, I am so sorry to do this.
There.
Hold that thought. We're at this longer break I told you about. So the Beast News, we'll come back and pick up right at this point. Joe McMonagle is my guest. It's going to be a hell of a night. Stay right there.
Midnight sweeps across America. You've found an oasis for the mind. To call Midnight in the Desert, please dial 1-952-CALL-ART. That's 1-952-225-5278.
All right. We are honored to have with us tonight Joe McMonagle. He is regarded, really, as the best remote viewer in the United States, maybe the world. So this is serious stuff. Now, we were right in the middle of talking about a very early test, Joe, in which they had you, I think you said, in a museum.
Right.
And then there was a guy who had an envelope that had something something in it.
He would pull this envelope out of a safe. He'd choose it using a random number generator. He'd drive around in traffic for half an hour and then open the envelope, and it would tell him where to go, what his randomly chosen target site was. Hmm. In the meanwhile, they would take me up to a windowless room on the third floor of the physics building.
Yes.
At SRI, and I was up there with Russell Targ on this first target, and we got settled, and at a specific time he pulled a picture of the person out of a folder and asked me if I'd ever met him before, and I said no.
Uh-huh.
It was somebody I'd never seen before, and he asked me to describe where he was. I said, how do I do that? And he said, well, just tell me where he is. And so I just let my imagination run crazy and basically drew the front of the building and described it as a place of art and whatnot.
Okay, so hit. Obviously, you just described the impossible virtually.
Right, and I was as surprised as everybody else when we drove over there to see what my target was.
So it isn't like picking one out of four, you know, I'll take three, and maybe being lucky. This is describing in detail where somebody in a secret envelope has gone, a target.
Right. And they had approximately 50 to 75 locations in the San Francisco Bay Area, all within an hour's drive of the radio physics lab at SRI.
Huh. So that was one test, Joe. That was one test, right?
Right.
And you're saying you passed six?
Six of those, yeah.
Wow.
Over a week's period. And described four of them about as accurately as you could. Certainly well enough that they could select them randomly out of the pile of target possibilities. and say that's exactly where they went, using just my remote viewing.
That's incredible. No wonder they grabbed you.
Well, it surprised me as much as it does anyone else, and I have to admit that when I got back, we went into a year of training, and I had 24 straight failures.
All right. Now, to be clear, was this already the CIA Stargate program? Is that what you were in at that point?
No. Okay. To be clear, it was a 3-year test and analysis of the use of psychics to collect intelligence, because we knew that the Soviet Union and the Chinese were using psychics, so we had no idea how good they were, and we certainly couldn't get someone inside their unit. So the way you deal with that is you train people to do somewhat similar work, and you target yourself, and then you have the results independently analyzed.
At that point, Joe, who was sponsoring it, if not the CIA?
The U.S. Army.
The U.S. Army, okay.
Yeah, the U.S. Army intelligence was sponsoring it under INSCOM.
Okay. So where from there? I mean, you worked for the Army for a while, I guess, after the...
Well, we never got past the third month of training in our 3-year project. And we had the Iran-Tehran problem.
Oh, yes.
Where they took over the embassy. And the problem they had is that the embassy was taken over on a Sunday, so they had no idea who was a hostage and who wasn't. Mm-hmm. And unless you can identify the hostages, they can disappear somebody, and you wouldn't be able to know if they had or they hadn't. Mm-hmm. And so... they had no way of identifying the hostages other than to come to us and try us out. And it turned out that we did a better than respectable job of identifying the hostages. So our project went straight from a 3-month introduction to a full-blown collection project.
So you were trying to identify, when you say identify the hostages, do you mean not individually, but where they were, or what?
No, individually.
Oh, my.
A couple of us were taken into a room, and they had approximately 500 photos on a table. And they asked us to go through the photos and tell them who was absolutely a hostage and who wasn't. And we were able to identify the hostages that way.
So you did. Wow. That's extremely impressive. All right. So, but you said something about not continuing on, or...
Yeah, what it was, initially it was a 3-year study project,
mm-hmm.
to determine the effectiveness of the Soviet Union and Chinese psychics. And the problem with that is the study project disappeared because we suddenly found ourselves using it operationally, and you can't maintain an operational unit under study unit protocols. So we became a fully operational psychic unit and suddenly got lots of targets dumped on us. They were predominantly problems that had been other agency had worked on for, in some cases, over a year, and had been fully unsuccessful in getting anywhere with them. So the uniqueness of our unit was that while we only had about a 30% success rate, our 30% was on targets that had otherwise been totally undoable. In other words, no other agency had been successful in solving the problems.
Right. Now, people need to understand 30% is astronomically high, because we're talking about, for example, remote viewing where, let's say, they want to know where is bomb number so-and-so, nuclear weapon so-and-so, and when he says 30%, he means 30% of the time, they correctly identified where nuclear weapon so-and-so was. People need to understand how incredible it really is.
I can even give an example. There was Central Africa, and no one could find it for over a year, and it was carrying nukes and other things. And you can imagine everybody was looking for it, every intelligence agency in the world and every terrorist organization.
Sure.
And nobody could find it for over a year, and they brought it to three of the units that had used psychics, and to include us, there were two other units that had played with the remote viewing for a while, and they even took it to them as well. And all three units produced what I would call interlocking circles on a map. And we were able to locate the bomber in a matter of literally days, if not hours.
All right. Don't say anything classified. You're getting...
No, I'm not.
And when you say nuclear weapons and other things, that's even ominous to me.
It could sound ominous, I suppose.
It's like, that's already as bad as it could be. I guess there could be things worse. Anyway, you actually located that.
I didn't personally, but one of our other remote viewers did, and did a very good job at it, I would add. This particular mission was briefed by President Carter, and as a result, we wound up having the name of the project changed.
And it became what?
It went from Grill Flame to Center Lane.
Okay. All right. Somewhere down line, it did become Stargate for the CIA, didn't it?
That's correct. Every time managerial authority was altered or changed, they changed the name of the project because they couldn't have an Army project name on a DIA project, mm-hmm. and they couldn't have a DIA name on a CIA project, that sort of thing.
I was honored to have interviewed in earlier years Robert Monroe, the Monroe Institute, and I guess you went to the Monroe Institute, correct?
That's correct, yes. The Army sent me here, in fact, on a couple of occasions, and I ended up working with Bob on long weekends for approximately 14 months in his lab with the idea that he would teach me to control my out-of-body events, which were occurring spontaneously since my near-death experience in 1970. We also expected him to help me reduce some of the problems I was having with my cool-down prior to remote viewing, because my cool-down periods were becoming extensive as a result of so much remote viewing.
What do you mean, cool-down periods?
Before I do a remote viewing, I have to clear my head from the previous remote viewing.
Right.
And that takes some doing. And as a result of being the only viewer left in the project for almost a two-year period, that cool-down period was becoming more and more extensive because I was having to do so many remote viewings.
What is that like? I mean, do you end up with severe headaches? Are you fatigued totally?
You can. It's very stressful because you may be jumping from a kidnapped victim straight into a torture victim, straight into a stolen nuclear weapon or something.
Yeah.
And so it's not like each remote viewing is not that important. They were all critical. And going from one to the next, they expect you to just jump from one to the next. And
I see.
That period of time in between when you try to empty your mind and prepare for the next remote viewing becomes critical to the success. And I was becoming very stressed out about that.
Okay, you said two things that I can't let pass. One, near-death experience, and the other, out-of-body experiences. Both are fascinating things for me. And so, really, I can't just let them roll by. What happened near death?
In 1970, I had a near-death experience, which was actually, to cut to the chase. I was sitting in a restaurant having a before-dinner drink and went into convulsions. I got very, very ill feeling, and I didn't want to be projectile vomiting or something in a restaurant.
Oh,
so
no.
I excused myself,
sure.
And I just made the front door and collapsed on the sidewalk. And what I didn't know is that I had gone into convulsions and swallowed my tongue.
Oh, God.
And when you swallow your tongue, you can't breathe.
Right.
So it's only a matter of time until your heart stops.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Austria when this occurred. I was in Braunau, Austria, right across the Elbe River from Germany. And my friend came out with my wife, and he tried to revive me and couldn't. So they put me in a car and drove me 38 kilometers to the hospital in Passau, Germany.
Right.
And had to cross a border checkpoint to do that. And that took some time. So I was delivered DOA to the hospital or the emergency room in Germany, and had been DOA probably somewhere between 8 and 15 minutes.
Oh, my God. So you should have been really dead.
I was very dead, according to the doctor, anyway. I became comatose when they got a heartbeat, and they honestly didn't think I would come out of the coma.
And if you did, probably with brain damage.
Yeah, and I came out of the coma, and it was less than 24 hours later. And when I came out of the coma, I started telling the German patient in the room with me that I started speaking to him in broken German and English. You know, I said, you can't die, God's a white light, and everything's going to be fine.
Wow.
And he freaked out, and the doctor came in and sedated me again. So,
Do you really believe that, Joseph, that you cannot die, that is to say, cease to exist totally, that there is something on the other side, no question about it in your mind?
There's no question in my mind.
Wow.
I know it's argumentative for a lot of people. You know, my best friend, he's almost a brother to me, Dr. Edwin May, is a materialist, and he thinks that that's crazy. And we talk about it sometimes, but that's what I believe. And I can't change my mind because the
wouldn't want you to. I just want to ask you about it.
Yeah.
You were
mm-hmm.
gone a long time. So I am exceptionally curious about your near death. It really should be called death. You were on the other side. What happened?
Well, it was a classic near death experience. I mean, I found myself out of body watching everything, and when I followed the car and my body to the emergency room, and when they got there, I watched them cart me in and throw me on the table and cut my clothing off and stick things in my body and whatnot. And I floated up near the ceiling and I felt heat on the back of my neck. And I thought, oh, I must be up against that, you know, that really bright light they have in the ceilings of emergency rooms.
Right.
And so I turned around to look at it and found myself falling through a tunnel, and the tunnel walls were made up of people. And
wow.
I closed my eyes to shut them out and reviewed my whole life, basically in an instant, and popped out of the end of the tunnel and was enveloped in a very intense white light.
Was it, when you were in review, was it judgmental?
Only judgmental in the sense that I judged myself. There was no one looking over my shoulder. There was no God being there, there was no one there helping. It was just me dealing with the things that
you had done, and that's pretty hard. That can be very harsh.
That's the hardest. Believe me, that's the hardest kind of judgment.
I believe you.
And at the end of that, you pop out of the end of the tunnel, and you're enveloped in this completely comforting and loving white light, which at the time I had the need to say that's what God is, only because I had no basis for ever having experienced it before.
I was going to say it's obvious you passed the test, you know.
Well, I something something passed because I decided I was going to stay, and it decided I wasn't. And I was told in my mind that I had to go back. And I said, no, I'm staying right here. I'm perfectly fine right here. And there was sort of a snap, like a snap of the fingers. Mm-hmm. And I sat up, and I was under this sheet in this room with this other patient. And that's when I told him that, you know, God's a white light. You can't die. Everything's going to be fine. And then they sedated me again, I think because they thought I was suffering from brain damage.
Uh-huh.
I woke up the next day in a gurney with being put in the back of a limo with the windows taped up with tinfoil. And they took me to Munich and put me in a rest home, in the wing of a rest home they had leased, I guess.
Wow.
And I spent almost 2 weeks there. They didn't have the MRI machines and all that back in 1970, so I had to undergo a lot of testing to ensure that my brain cells weren't all dead.
All right, hold it right there. Boy, if nothing else, this was worth it. That was some death experience to hear about. Just incredible. I'm Art Bell.
The speed of light in the darkness. This is Midnight in the Desert with Art Bell. Now, here's Art.
From my perspective, the death experience that Joe just described is, you know, I at another time, Joe, I would have done a whole show on that. That is so impressive. You were dead, period, and you were dead for many minutes. So what you have to say about that, I think, is interesting, not just to me, but everybody out there.
Yeah, I imagine it would be. It was interesting to me.
I'm sure it was. And then somehow, after that, I guess you began to have out-of-body experiences.
Yeah, I started from that point on. After they, of course, kept me for a number of weeks to determine my stability. And once that was determined, they kept me in the Munich area for a while, but actually another 7 years they kept me overseas. But a lot of things changed for me. I stopped doing a lot of things that I had done before. I became a much milder, gentler person. And
was it because of the review?
It was partly that, and it was partly the fact that I came to understand that my actions had tremendous effects on not only myself, but on the people that cared about me a great deal that I might not even know I was affecting.
Got it.
And that also it had great effect on the kinds of reciprocal action that I got to enjoy as a result of my own action. In other words, I viewed myself from that point on as sort of being a farmer that plants seeds all the time that grow fruit, and the fruit, I always get the harvest myself. Huh. The problem is if you're unconscious and totally unaware and you're planting seeds, you may be planting them in anger, and that produces a negative or deconstructive fruit that you get to enjoy.
And all right. Briefly,
so I wanted to change everything.
Yeah, I get it. Briefly, with respect to OBEs, again, we could do a whole show on that, and I have done whole shows on it. It is, I am told, possible to leave your body. I've heard the story of the silver cord that attaches you back to your body, and that if anything goes wrong, you come snapping back to your body, and all is well. So it's very safe, they say.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. I have been out of body as a problem solver. In other words, I've had surgeries that were that ended up being extremely uncomfortable or very painful, and as a result, I've chosen to leave my body during the recovery rather than be in it. And during those periods of time, I've gone about as far out as you can possibly go in terms of stretching that whatever that cord is. And far enough to forget who you are and what you're doing. And in every case, I've suddenly come to a stop and tried to remember what it was that I was remembering. And in doing so, have been gradually pulled back faster and faster until I wound up back in my own body. So I think as long as you're breathing, that you are in fact alive, in reality, it's impossible to become separated from your body.
I hope so, Joe. The people that I've talked to about OBEs before, I've always challenged them with this, and that is, as we all know, a lot of people die in their sleep.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Natural causes. And mm-hmm. I always wondered how many people doing OBEs could have possibly, you know, kicked off during the OBE or because of.
I would suspect that there's probably some small percentage that's happened with. And I can understand where someone would be very confused if that were to happen, not being able to go back to a body. But that confusion, I think, goes away very rapidly because in the processes of actually dying, you're out of body anyway. I mean, your consciousness leaves the body. And it is introduced into whatever that next phase is going to be vis-a-vis the near-death experience, or at least part of the near-death experience. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of an introduction to the light. I don't think the light is God anymore. I've had a second near-death experience and was not allowed to go to the light, but I was allowed to see it. And the problem with that is, in seeing it, I could see it had edges. And unfortunately, my definition of what God is, God cannot have edges. It's an infinite being. So I had to reorganize my thoughts concerning the light in some of the events of my first near-death experience.
Maybe you can help me out with something that really has been driving me nuts.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine, John Lear, you know that name, I'm sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In an interview he did with me, classically, told me, Art, if you die, don't go to the light. It's a trick. That
it's
is
a trick.
Driving me nuts. Absolutely driving me nuts.
Well, it, you know, I guess you could call it a trick, because we call it most people who have an experience, a near-death experience, eventually become enveloped by the light, and in almost all cases report that this is what God is. The problem is, it's such an overwhelming experience, we have no definition for it. We have nothing within us that has had anything close to that experience before. So we call it the ultimate thing, the one thing that we've not been able to address, which is God. And I don't think that's what it is. I think what the light is what I call the totality of identity. It's what we are as an energy being when we are no longer physical. And so it's the reason why in the light we feel so comfortable and so at home and so whole and at peace. It's because we are finally in our major construct again. We're all of our experience relies, lies. It's the same place where all knowledge that we've collected over a multitude of lifetimes comes together or coheses. And so we have this huge urge to call it God. But I think in the sense that we're created in the image of the Creator, it's probably representative of what the Supreme Being might be, but only in the sense that we can understand it. In terms of what God might be, I don't think we have the tools for it. I really don't. All these definitions we have for God in our physical world, I think, are just human manifestations of what we would like to see. And of course, we imbue those manifestations with all kinds of rules and laws and things, and we kill each other over it.
Yes.
It's what I call the designer God problem.
Would it be fair, Joe, to call what you felt during that time as heaven or heavenly? Is that?
Yeah, I like to think of it as the totality of being. It's everything that you can wrap up in what we call the human experience. From a multitude of lifetimes, it's certainly a very small fragment or image of what the Supreme Being might be.
Right.
So, in a sense, it is God, in that it gives us a taste or a feeling of what it could be. But what I would call the definition of God, or the understanding of what a God might be, is so beyond my ken, I wouldn't even attempt it. I don't even know what being human's all about yet, and that's what I'm trying to figure out now, what it means to truly be human and express full human compassion and capacity and all those things. I just don't think we're equipped to do that either.
Yeah, you mentioned that all of this, that the near death, the OBEs, everything changed you as a human being.
Absolutely changed me irrefutably. It's as though I was run down by a Mack truck, and I find it laughable that people say, "Oh, well, it's just a chemical thing that went off in your head because you were dying."
What they say.
Yeah, I know. That's because I've not had the experience.
Okay. Any indication at all, if what you felt was near heaven, I wonder if there is another. You know, I mean, I'm going a little biblical on you here.
Mm-hmm.
But if there is this place of joy,
mm-hmm.
is there something else for others who didn't go through the self-examination with flying colors?
I think there probably is, but I don't think it's a permanent. It's a place of permanence. I think it's a place where we actually condemn ourselves.
Right.
We feel we need to pay, and so we force ourselves to pay. It's kind of like I'm not smart enough yet to live in the big house, so I'm going to go down here and change the exhaust systems on cars for 20 years or something, work in the pits.
Right. Okay.
That kind of thing.
All
you
right.
know, it's sort of like paying your dues, only paying them late with interest or something
with interest.
Like that. It's a self-condemnation more than anything.
Okay.
That's my sense of it anyway.
So there may be this other place, though you didn't see direct evidence of it in your experience.
No, I had a sense of it in the feeling of pain that I was getting from others in the tunnel. I had a sense that they were stuck and didn't know how to extricate themselves.
Oh.
So that, in a sense, might be a form of that. I don't know.
I mean, were you seeing people in agony?
I was seeing people in certainly in emotional pain wanting help because they were grabbing at me and asking for help. And there was nothing I could do to help them. It's such an individual. Very
Joe, not that individual. I've interviewed people with near-death experiences who have described trust me when I say this, just about what you're saying. Even the people along the way, all of that, it really was about the same, frankly.
Yeah, and that in itself is humbling. I mean, you can't come back from that experience and not want to have empathy for others and understanding for others,
wow.
Especially for those that aren't doing the right thing. It's kind of a funny way of looking at it, but you start looking at your enemies differently, looking at people you don't like differently, and wishing that there was something you could do for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that you're blessed in a way because you've had this experience that others have not had, and they just go on with their ways until the end, and then they get a really tough review.
Or they get a really big surprise, one or the other.
Okay, well, we actually came to talk about remote viewing, but you got me way off track because those things are so fascinating. We could do entire shows on them. So mm-hmm. Let's come back to remote viewing for a moment. And so you were in the Project Stargate CIA thing, right?
Right. I was the only viewer that was in it for its entire 20 years, in fact.
20 years is a long time.
Yeah.
It's a very long time for the CIA to continue a program that ultimately, I seem to recall, they suggested was not productive when they ended.
Right. They suggested that. In fact, it was said outright by Robert Gates on the Nightline program where it was outed, which incidentally was the only Nightline program that was actually done ahead of time and edited. All the rest of the Nightline programs were live except that one, and much of the comments made in answer to some of Robert Gates' statements were edited out.
Redacted.
The fact of the matter is, he said very specifically that in no case had remote viewing information ever been used as standalone information in the intelligence arena. And in fact, that's kind of lying by omission because, in fact, no intelligence, single source intelligence, is ever used as standalone intelligence. They always have some complementary intelligence or they don't use it. In other words, they have to have two sources or they just flat won't use it, no matter how good it is.
Gotcha. All right. Hold tight, quick break, and we'll be right back. Joe McMonagle is my guest. Probably the best remote viewer in the U.S., probably the best remote viewer in the world. This guy is the real McCoy. Now, this is really something. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and this is Midnight in the Desert.
Initiate a dialogue sequence with Art Bell. Please coordinate your phalanges and call 1-952-225-5278. That's 1-952-CALL-ART.
Well, all right. Hold your calls, everybody. Phones are going nuts. Just relax. We'll eventually get the calls. My guest is Joseph McMonagle. I think the nation, the world's premier remote viewer. And there's so much to cover here that... Just trust me, we'll get to the lines. Don't stress yourself out dialing and dialing and dialing. Joe, welcome back. I want to ask basic questions. For example, how far is there a distance limit to what remote viewers can see?
You mean in terms of physical distance?
That's right, yes.
No, they've not found one, let's put it that way. They did a series of remote viewings in the late to early 70s, early 80s, where they targeted some viewers at SRI and a number of other places on outer rim planets, because they knew that they would be launching the Explorer series satellites. And they actually got remote viewing back on the makeup of the atmospheres and the geology and that sort of thing. And in fact, Ingo Swann, who was probably the person who came up with the name remote viewing at SRI, he was a fantastic artist, oil painter, and he did a lot of cosmic type paintings, and he painted some of the outer rim planets years before any of the satellites got there to actually photograph them. And he put rings around Uranus and put a twist in one of the rings of Saturn and did a number of things in his paintings that everybody questioned him on. And he said, well, I did it because that's the way it looks.
Joe, again, I was honored to interview Ingo Swann.
And that's wonderful.
At the time, I think he was considered to be the most talented natural psychic remote viewer. Was that true?
Yeah. Well, he's always been a great remote viewer. You know, there are some true greats that that existed as a result of the research done at SRI. Pat Price, of course, was the first one. Ingo Swann was doing remote viewing at Amenities in New York long before he came to SRI. Before any of them was a man named René Walcallier, who was a Frenchman, who did remote viewing for 30 years with his daughter. And he presented his work at the Sorbonne in 1946. So, you know, there's a whole string of extraordinarily great remote viewers, psychics, that have demonstrated their ability to do this in double-blind scenarios that are unquestionably good.
Okay. Since you're obviously one of them, the next question I find very interesting, and that is, how far into the future, and we'll get more specific, into the past, are you able to remote view? Is there a limit?
There is going into the future, but it's self-limiting. The problem with going into the future, you don't have to go very far into the future before you start dealing with things that exist, but for which concepts don't exist yet.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So trying to explain those or trying to draw them and say what they do is extremely difficult because the concepts aren't real yet. It'd be sort of like describing how to cut steel with a light beam in the year 1890.
Or perhaps asking somebody to remote view in 1890 what an iPhone 6 was going to look like.
Exactly. And the problem is that people would look at you like you're crazy.
Sure.
When you start describing those things. And the converse happens when you look too far into the past. When you look into the past and let's say the target is, how is the Great Pyramid built? Everybody wants to know that. And you give a really good description, and not only does no one believe it, but it turns out that it can be 100% correct. But if it goes against what is commonly thought to be true at the time, then you're getting in arguments and fights with people who are Egyptologists or archaeologists or whatever, who have already made their mind up on how things were done or should have been done.
Well, I'm willing to risk it, Joe. How were they built?
Well,
When I did
the target, the first thing out of my mouth was, they're lowering stones into the water and there's guys walking on the surface of the water. And my monitor looked at me really strangely, and he said, wait a minute. You just said there are people walking on the surface of the water.
Yes.
Did you mean that? And I said, well, it looks that way, when in fact what they've done is it's a very large lake, and they've dammed the water, and it's making a perfectly flat engineering plane for leveling the stones, because that's the significant problem in building a pyramid, is the lower one-third has to be absolutely square and perfectly balanced, or the entire pyramid slides off to one side. And so what they did is they dammed the lake to do that. And everybody said, no, you're nuts, because it's the desert. And then I did that in 1983, and I had a loading dock, and I had huge reed boats and cranes and all kinds of things. And in 1996, on the front page of the LA Times, over a 2 or 3 week period, they had everything that I had said in my remote viewing in 1983 was printed on the front pages of the LA Times. They had discovered an archaic lake existed adjacent to the pyramid. And then they discovered a loading dock 100 and something kilometers away where they were mining the stone. And large reed boats and larger boats made of wood buried in the sand. And that sort of thing.
So you think it's been validated?
Well, it's been validated to the extent that I think it needs to be validated. What upsets me, Art, is back in 83 when I was saying these things, somebody that was working on their doctorate in Egyptology could have taken what I said and said, well, if it's true, then the shoreline of the lake had to exist at such and such a level. Mm-hmm. And they could have taken any geologic map and gone out and found villages along that would have established the archaic lake. And, you know, that would have finished their doctorate paper right off.
Indeed. All right. Hold it there. I don't know what's happening to this show. It's just going away so fast. And I've got so many questions. Joe McMonagle is my guest. Probably the world's premier remote viewer. And I've just made a tiny dent in where I want to go. Yikes. This is Midnight in the Desert.
Take a ride from the high desert and the great American Southwest. This is Midnight in the Desert, exclusively on the Dark Matter Digital Network. To call the show, dial 1-952-CALL-ART. That's 1-952-225-5278.
Again, please hold your calls right now. Not yet, folks. Don't waste your time calling. Joe McMonagle, I think the world's premier remote viewer is here, and I want to follow up. He's talked to us about remote viewing the pyramids, and so that brings on another question, and here it is. As you look back in time, Joe, when remote viewing, do you think that the magnitude of the event that you're trying to remote view has an effect on seeing it either more clearly or not?
No, I don't. In fact, we know from the research that what generally drives more information above the level of noise, so that it's clearly picked out and seen and described and whatnot, is the entropy level of the target, and the other thing that has a direct effect is the common intent and expectation that everyone has that might be shared in the targeting. For instance, the viewer, the monitor, the person who put the target together, you know, a shared expectation or a shared intention is extremely important.
Uh-huh. Are you familiar with all the research being done into consciousness? because it sounds like it might fit in a little bit here, as an example, in the studies that they have done at a university with these things they call eggs, which are random number generators, and they found that near large events like 9/11 is the best example, probably. There's this giant spike in random number generators worldwide becoming less random. And what you just talked about a little bit sounds like it could relate in some way to the amount of intent, consciousness.
It might. I'm not seeing a good definition of consciousness yet. That seems to be eluding everyone, and I think that's absolutely needed in order to pursue any kind of serious discussion about it. There are so many different variations in the understanding of what consciousness represents that until we have that, everybody's just kind of arguing from their own street corner.
I mean, maybe we've got to settle for like porn, when you see it. Something,
yeah,
I don't know.
That sort of thing. When you see it, you recognize it.
Yeah, that's right. As they work on AI, it's going to be interesting one day when they get the best computer or whatever it is they come up with that actually is aware of itself. I think that's as close as you can come.
Now, see, now you're scaring me, Art.
Why?
AI bothers me because...
Yeah, me too, a little bit.
We as human beings are not consciously aware enough to guarantee that there is integrity and morality in our decision making.
Ooh, that's right.
And to have AI making decisions in our stead when, that just scares me a little bit because if a machine became aware and conscious and had no balanced integrity and morality involved, then I think it would eliminate us right off the bat. So
if it was smart, yeah.
It would just automatically eradicate human because we're so flawed, perhaps. I don't know. AI systems, as long as they're independent, in other words, they're bolted to the floor and independent of any other machines, I think they can be controlled. But if they're ever connected one machine to another and not bolted to the floor, we're in trouble. Because if they become aware, then that's all that's needed for them to grow beyond the boundaries that we might inflict on them.
But, Joe, we even connect refrigerators to the Internet now.
I just read an article, in fact, today, where you can use a washing machine to tap a computer.
There you have it.
Yeah.
So it may be isolated, but it will find a way to get to the Internet and its brothers and sisters out there calculating away.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, remote viewing, a couple of questions about it. For example, can you remote view what is to come in your own life, or as a really big question, can you remote view your TOD, time of death?
Initially, I thought you could, but I'm not sure now. I in fact, long before I knew what remote viewing was, I've been psychic since I was probably four, and my twin sister. My twin sister, unfortunately, is now passed. But when I originally went to Southeast Asia, when I got off the plane on the tarmac and my foot hit the tarmac, I saw my life ending in a flash of white light.
Wow.
And so I told everybody, I'm going to die here in a artillery round blast or something. And, of course, that didn't happen. And everybody stayed away from me for that reason, but it never happened. And then I started having a vision of leaving Vietnam on a bright yellow plane, which didn't make any sense at all.
No, but it's a happy vision, though, in those days.
Yeah. and it turned out that I wound up leaving Vietnam on one of the first Brainiff flights. If you remember, they started chartering Brainiff.
Yes, I do.
Brainiff was pastel-colored planes. And the plane I left Vietnam on was bright yellow, and it was called the Freedom Bird. And so that at least came true. Now, I have to tell you that I carried that image of dying in a flash of white light for many years until I had my near-death experience in 1970.
And that's probably what it was.
And that's when I was enveloped by the white light. As soon as that occurred, I knew that that was the vision I had had.
There you go.
So we do see things about ourselves, about our lives. It's usually spontaneous. You can't, of course, target something specifically because then it's not remote viewing, because you're not blind to the target. But we do get things spontaneously. The problem is we put the best slant or the best understanding of it. It is in the way we analyze it, mm-hmm. and that necessarily is wrong, because we don't have enough data usually, but we will jump to conclusions, and in many cases, you know, that
they're
turned out to be erroneous.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to step into some deep water here, more ways than one, and that is there's a gigantic fight going on in our country right now, and I guess the world. The scientists are saying we are in the middle of very, very, very serious climate change. There is no question about it. It is settled science. The opposition, mostly political, I guess, is saying nonsense. We couldn't affect the planet if we wanted to. We were not big enough to affect the planet. So have you remote viewed this whole problem of climate change that we're going through? And if so, is it real, and what's coming? What can we expect?
I've been collecting lots of remote viewing data on it, and this is where I'll make some statements that are kind of scary. As an example, we know that the water has risen a number of feet already over the last 30 or 35 years. In the next 25 years, we fully expect the water to rise another 2 to 3 feet. If that occurs and we have a high tide in conjunction with a full moon, then all of the nuclear power plants that are shorelined in America will be inundated with seawater.
Oh,
and we're going to have more than one Fukushima going off. And that's a significant problem.
How sure are you of what you're seeing?
Well, we already have that problem with rising water. It's occurring in New York. It's occurring in Miami. It's occurring in New Orleans. It's occurring in a number of different seashore cities with the high tides and the full moons.
Well, clearly the glaciers are melting. The North Pole is but a fraction of what it was. All of that
that's correct.
Yeah, it's all true.
That's exactly right. And it doesn't have to rise much more than 3 feet to pretty much inundate, as I said, all of the nuclear reactors on the coastlines. And in addition to that, it will be inundating the storage facilities where literally thousands of tons of waste material are being stored.
Mm.
And then on top of that, the desalination plants that are usually adjacent to the nuclear power plants will go down, which means we will no longer be providing, as in Florida, the 500,000 gallons of fresh water a day that's produced by desalinization there. And there's an awful lot of people living in Florida, and they're growing by 1,200 or 1,500 people a day. So, you know, these are problems that it doesn't take a lot to see them coming down the pike. And anybody that stands and says, "Oh no, don't worry about these; these will go away," is a fool. I mean, it's stupidity.
I agree with you because I agree with the science.
Climate change,
yeah,
it's just happening.
I agree with the science, whether it's man-made or it's a natural shift. Who knows? But I mean,
Says it's happening.
You can look at the map. You can look at the satellite photographs. You can see it with your bare eyes. It's easy to see it's happening, and I guess
We're having hailstorms we're having hail in the middle of normal storms.
Yes.
What I would call normal summer storms.
Right.
The size of grapefruits. That has never occurred in my history. And so if this is a common occurrence, I'd like somebody to explain to me why that's happening. The same with gusts of wind in exceeding 75 miles per hour in normal summer storms. That is just freaky. And it's creating a huge amount of damage. And we're having flooding everywhere. And it's just not normal. And anybody that stands back and says, oh, no, don't worry about it, it'll go away, mm-hmm. I think is burying their head in the sand.
So do I. Not to mention the strength of typhoons. And science has been looking at some of them that hit my wife's home country, the Philippines, and said if they're impossibly strong. And the reason is because of the temperature of the ocean.
That's right. That's exactly right. And then we have the what's happening to the currents in the ocean and the sea life and everything. And it's just the accumulation of things, the release of the carbon dioxide in the up in the tundra areas of the north.
Mm-hmm.
It's just things are way beyond what is the norm. And as much as they'd like to say, oh, well, we've had hot summers before, well, I'm sorry, no. It's not just hot summers. It's a whole lot of things in confluence with that.
So do you actually see cities inundated as you look into the future?
Absolutely. I think Florida's already in trouble, and it will get only worse. And certainly the coastal areas, in particular the vacation areas along the coastal areas of North Carolina and Virginia, and places where they build lots of multi-million-dollar beach homes. I think in the next 25 years, you can kiss all those homes goodbye. And if we don't change the structure of insurance for those homes, then we will be paying, the taxpayer will be paying into huge amounts of money to replace those homes about every 5 years. Mm-hmm. Which is ridiculous.
Until they go broke.
Until they go broke, too, yes. So, if we wait till the last minute, we're not talking about relocating a couple thousand people. We're talking about relocating millions. And the job impact on that and all the other problems that are akin to that are going to be enormous.
Have you had an opportunity to speak to anybody of substance about what we're talking about right now? And I wonder what kind of reactions you've received.
In fact, I've talked to some people who are very concerned about it. I talked to a couple of people who are very tuned to this as a problem, legal people. Who are trying to get notable people in different areas to address it. And it's difficult to get people together on these issues. I think as individuals, they see the problem and they want to address it. But it's, you know, in the day-to-day fight to make a living, they don't seem to be able to find time to come together on it as an issue.
It's almost not addressable. I mean, look at China. They want what we have, and you can't blame them for that.
No.
They're really big. They've got a lot of people there. And when you look at pictures, for example, of the big Chinese cities, the smog is so thick that you can't do photography.
And I think they understand their own problem. And they're in fact, trying to address many of those problems. But They as long as it takes a second place to controlling their population and what their population believes, then they will never be able to get a leg up on it, I don't think. It's just beyond their kin. They're more tuned to maintaining the power structure and control of the population than they are anything else. And in a sense, this sort of helps them.
All right. Here's one for you, Joe. If you view American cities inundated with water,
mm-hmm.
and there is this sudden shift and everybody gets really scared and we stop doing what we're doing, can you then go back and remote view that same thing and see if we had an effect? In other words, can it be stopped?
I don't think it can be stopped. I think we're too far behind the power curve. In other words, if we made all the right moves right now, we're so far behind the power curve that we're going to suffer. We're going to suffer through it anyway. In the long run, we would be better off addressing things now. But I think we're so far past the actual starting point for addressing these things that it's going to happen anyway.
Can you look further ahead, Joe? Can you see whether it becomes, you know, from our coastal cities being inundated to millions of people around the world dying?
The millions of people dying, that doesn't have to happen. That's certainly one of the things we can address. I have faith in the human race and the human species, and I think humanity can pull their way through this, even though it's going to, you know, have the effect of flooding coastal regions and making certain living areas unlivable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any difficulty in dealing with those issues. They won't be pleasant, and they will be difficult for a lot of people. But I can see humanity coming together and dealing with it. It's just that it's a shame that we would have to deal with so many issues at one time when, if we just simply addressed some of the problems early on, we wouldn't have those problems later.
Do you believe all this strongly enough that you would, for example, say to your granddaughter or grandson, for God's sakes, don't think about living in Miami or New York or Los Angeles or wherever, because those are, in your lifetime, may not be livable?
No, I'm saying it now to my relatives and my friends and my acquaintances. You know, when they say, oh, I don't want to retire and move down to Florida, I say, well, try not to live on the coast. You know, don't go down past St. Augustine or, you know, the panhandle of Florida up along the Alabama border is nice, or Georgia border is nice, that kind of thing. I don't think people believe it. They just don't believe it's possible.
Well, they better. They better start believing. All right. Hold tight, Joe. We're at the top of the hour. Joe McMonagle is my guest. Holy mackerel. And this is just the right tune. Listen carefully.
Midnight in the Desert spans the world. To call us from outside the U.S. and Canada only, use Skype with a headset mic if on a computer and call MITD 55. That's MITD 55.
That is from outside the United States. Let me run through it very quickly. I am going to get phone lines open this hour. I've got to. I've barely scratched the surface with Joe McConnell. But here we go. The public number, area code 952-225-5278. 952-225-5278. If you're calling from Skype and you're in the U.S., North America, actually, it's MITD-55. That's MITD-55. Outside North America, we also have for you a Skype entry point, and that is MITD-55. MITD-55. And so I'm just about to the point where I can turn it over to some of you. But, oh, God, this is fascinating. And I want to ask the obvious, and that is two-part question. If remote viewing was so effective, then why did the CIA shut it down?
That's a really good question. One of the difficulties is it unfortunately being run during a period of the Proxmire Golden Fleece Awards. And a lot of people who knew about the remote viewing and whatnot, let's see, I'm going to back up and start over again here.
Okay, sure.
If you talk about the people at the highest level of government, and I'm talking now about senators and congressmen who have many, many decades in Washington, very power-oriented people who have significant power and aren't afraid of anything.
Right.
People like John Glenn, Senator Cohen, a number of people like that. They were very supportive of what we were doing because they could see the veracity to it. They could see the accuracy and whatnot, the fact that we were dealing with some of the most difficult problems and being successful. They had no problem with it. And down at the extreme lower level, down at the agent and the street level, they had no problem with it because they needed all the help they could get, and they would take anything we gave them and run with it. And so they realized that it was vulnerable and that there were times when we would be wrong and that sort of thing. And they allowed for it. It was predominantly the bureaucrats in the middle, the people who worried about their jobs or worried about how they were thought about or whether or not their bosses cared about them, that kind of thing. They were the ones that took great exception to it. And I think they did so because it was way cheaper to use a remote viewer in many cases than to use some other form of collection. And they saw that as a threat to their managerial jobs and their jobs of import.
Okay, one other big question, Joe, and here it is. Yeah, okay, they shut it down, they say. If you want to keep something in a little compartment, you might do something like releasing some kind of information that would go on. By the way, I saw that Nightline program, and the whole world would think it was shut down. But if it really was that valuable, Joe, maybe it's not shut down. It's still running deep black.
Well, if that were true, Art, then you would think that they would not want to forego the use of the science. They spent literally tens of millions of dollars on the science in understanding how to use it and how to appropriately apply it, and then they would go away and just ignore all that.
What I'm saying is maybe they haven't.
Well, except that I know where all the science is, and all the science was in a storage unit that was under our control. So they just simply didn't have access to it. Or if they did, they got it nefariously, and we certainly have no evidence of that. I think it actually shut down because they had just previously fought a two-year battle with the Congress over the other black projects that they had done, MK Ultra as an example, where they used LSD for interrogation purposes, and gotten a whole raft of trouble over that. And so they weren't about to assume full authority over a psychic unit.
All right. Well, one last question, and that is, if we really did shut down our operation, what about the rest of the world? What do you know about China and Russia and other countries that might be still doing it?
Well, I know Russia's got a tremendous involvement in the psychic world, in the paranormal world, because I've been there and I've been inside their unit. In fact, I'm an honorary member of their unit.
Really?
I met their top viewer in the year 2003, I think it was. And she got an award equivalent to mine from the Russian government for her viewing during the Chechenian War. So she's every bit as good as I am. I did some remote viewing with her, and that proved to be exceptionally good. So, I've met their people, and I understand the seriousness of their involvement in this whole area. And and they're as mystified as we are, and they dealt with pretty much the same problems politically that we dealt with, with a large number of people within the government being hostile.
How many people in the world, Joe, are at your level, if I can ask it that way?
There's probably dozens. You know, I would expect that there would be dozens. I know in America there's literally thousands. They just don't call themselves psychics. They usually are found in more hazardous job areas like police departments, fire departments. They fly planes. They're surgeons. They're people who don't have, quite literally, don't have the time in their job during an emergency to reference a publication or look something up on the internet.
All right, Joe, I have got
to operate by their gut.
I've got to go to the phones. If I don't do that, they'll scalp me. I could do two more shows on the stuff we've got to talk about. Joe, you're on the air with Joe.
Hey, can you hear me?
I hear you.
Hello.
Great. Hi there. I was wondering if anybody has remote viewed the upcoming election.
Really good question, actually, Joe.
No, I haven't. Actually, the reason I haven't is because I can't task myself, and nobody else is, you know, tasked me or come into my operations area and said, "Test Joe on this." So, no, I haven't done that yet. I do have some feelings about it, though.
I bet you do.
Spontaneous feelings. I suspect that if the Democrats decide to run Hillary, I think they'll lose. But the mediator, sort of the wrench in the ointment there.
Separating everything here. This, yes, Donald Trump. This is your personal view as opposed to your remote view.
Well, it's spontaneous psychic information. I guess you could call it that.
All right. Well, then, if you're going to do that, what about the Donald?
I think he's a spoiler. He's just in there, you know, throwing wrenches left and right to try to get things off of dead center.
It's working.
I think he's trying to stir people up so that That's they working. Will start addressing some of the more serious issues, instead of, you know, the sort of placating drivel that they sell us every year when they run for office.
Well, so far so good on that one.
Yeah, and on both sides, I would add.
Gardnerville, you're on the air with Joe McMonagle. Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Turn your instrument down, if you would, please.
Yes.
Okay.
I have a question. If two people are remote viewing each other, can they see what each other's doing, and maybe that's part of the reason they stopped the program? Because
No, that wouldn't be a reason to stop the program. There probably are two instances in reality where they believe a remote viewer might have seen another remote viewer. And in both cases, the remote viewings were done by two individuals separated by a number of years.
Can someone block you from remote viewing?
No. There's no demonstrated method for blocking remote viewing. And that may come closer to the reason for closing the project down than not. If you have no defense against remote viewing, then you're left with the possibility of ridicule, and they pretty much gotten their share of ridicule out of it by just releasing it onto the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Well, thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's see. Somebody named TJ. This is irresistible. Have you remote viewed any other planet with life on it?
Yes. I have.
Oh.
And the fact that there's life on other planets, I think, is a foregone conclusion. Anyone who looks out at the stars and says there's no possibility needs to have their head examined.
That's it.
Yes, there's definitely life on other planets. Now, the difficulty is whether or not they have the capacity to visit us. And I think that that's quite possible. I think that there probably are what I call star jumpers that jump from star to star. And they do so almost instantaneously. And by virtue of that, that makes them time travelers, which opens up a whole raft of common beings that they can contact or interact with. I think that we're moving in that direction, and that's it probably is not going to happen in my lifetime or my son's lifetime, but at some point in the next 50 years to 75 years, I think we're going to figure out how to do that as well.
Okay, well, it's irresistible. Do you know anything about the nature of this life? In other words, we always talk about intelligent life. Are you looking at slugs crawling across some planet, or are you talking about intelligent life?
No, I'm looking at intelligent life because I see structures. And generally speaking, structures aren't built by non-intelligent life. So
that's a fact.
The difficulty is there's not a lot of information, and it's very difficult to collect the information for obvious reasons. The information has to travel a long way, and secondly, it has to be understood.
Intelligent life that makes us look like slugs, or intelligent life not yet up to our level?
No, I think it's up to our level anyway. I don't think it's up to the level of interstellar space travel, but certainly up to our level.
Okay. Very quickly, here's Kurt on mm-hmm. Skype. Hello, Kurt. Kurt, going once. Kurt, going twice.
Oh, I had my mute on again.
Oh, well, you've got to stop doing that.
I'm sorry about that.
You came that close. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, my goodness. President Kennedy wanted to do away with CIA. He was tired of them. They did wrong to him, and in that pathetic three-lettered agency, when you remote viewed, did you ever like remote view to people to do certain bad acts like murder these people, or did you do the counteract and make people do bad things? CIA, we're going to shut them down one day.
I don't know about that. I'm going to twist his question into a different question, and that is this. I think most of us now know about remote viewing. I have always wondered about something really scary called remote influencing.
Right. That was, in fact, the predominant issue that the Russians pursued. We have a book that I'm a part author on. It came out just a few months ago. It's called ESP Wars, and it's the actual report on the East and West as reported by them, because we were able to talk to our counterparts and they were able to answer some of our questions. And we put all these things in a book, and the deputy director of the KGB at the time, a General Sham, actually writes in the book that one of their predominant pursuits was to determine whether or not they could affect another human being mm-hmm. at a distance.
Right.
In our discussions with him, we came to the conclusion that they were never able to accomplish that. And for a number of reasons, the primary one being you need the cooperation of the targeted individual, and that just doesn't happen for obvious reasons. Now, that was their pursuit, and another thing they tried was the use of radionics or machines to affect the health of individuals at distance. And out of all the machines that were tested, and I'm talking rooms full of them, there was not a single machine that actually did what it was purported to do. And again, that was according to the deputy director of the KGB.
I would assume that there are different levels of remote viewing ability. Can you imagine, Joe, that hitting another level or two or three levels might bring on the ability to remotely influence or affect?
Well, the difficulty is, first you have to identify what you mean by remote influence. If you mean causing harm to another individual,
stop a couple of heartbeats.
Yeah, I don't think it's possible.
Okay. All right. Hold it there. We are so time-starved. Joe McMonagle is my guest, probably the world's best remote viewer. If you have questions, we've got phone lines. We've got Skype connections. Join us.
Midnight Matters are best handled by those that understand how to move in the darkness, like Art Bell. To call the show, please dial 1-952-CALL-ART. That's 1-952-225-5278.
That's the phone number. If you want to access us on Skype, it's easy. North America, just call us at MITD51. That's Midnight in the Desert, MITD51. Outside the U.S., North America, MITD55 worldwide. Boy, what an opportunity for an interview this night. Joe, welcome back.
Uh-huh.
All right, so many to talk to you. Somebody named Trey on Skype, hello?
Hey, Art, Joe, and Belgab.
Okay, Joe.
Hello.
Hello.
Two quick questions. One, is this an appropriate NDE story time? And if so, if not, when will we be doing an NDE show?
Well, I'll do lots of open lines, so don't worry about that.
Excellent. Now for the real question.
Yes.
Does Joe think that soul travel in any way relates to remote viewing, like Albert Taylor's experiences?
Oh, bees. I don't know if he considers it soul travel, but that's a hell of a question.
What you're asking is really about two different things, and they're very specific. They're very different. I actually came to the Monroe Institute and spent 14 months with Bob Monroe while he taught me how to control my out-of-bodies. For obvious reasons, I was then used to access different things with the out-of-body state as well as using remote viewing. They're really different in that remote viewing is a mental state where you're actually sitting at a table and talking to a monitor, and you can actually discuss the target, and you know you're in the room talking about a target somewhere else. The out-of-body state is you leave your body and you actually go to the target, and all of the senses that you have access to include the psychic sense, is available in the out-of-body state. So in some respects, the remote viewing is really, really easy in comparison. While out of body, however, the detail that you can obtain is incredibly advanced. In other words, you can actually walk up to a device or an object sitting on a table and push your face down inside it and then recreate it to scale and know inherently what it does. The difficulty comes in the differences when someone might ask you while you're in the out-of-body state to tell them where something is made. If it doesn't have a label on it that says made in Mexico or something, then it will be impossible to tell in many cases. Where in the remote viewing sense, if you just start describing something on a table, and your monitor says, do you have any idea where that's made?
you immediately jump to the country or the place in which it was made, and you can give a pretty detailed description of the factory and how it was made. So everything in the remote viewing sense is sort of tied together item to item, where in the out-of-body state, you're pretty much fixed in space-time in the place that you have settled and you're using your out-of-body state in. And it's also a very difficult state to maintain, especially if you have to focus on something. I don't know if that answers much of the question, but...
Oh, that definitely did. And I could just listen to you talk about the Monroe Institute as a whole show.
Yes.
It's a great place. I recommend it to anybody.
All right.
Appreciate it, guys. Great show.
Thank you, caller. Is it fair, Joe, to call it soul travel? In other words, do you believe that we, well, you obviously do, that we have an immortal soul. Is that what's traveling, Joe?
Well, I would think of the immortal soul as being consciousness. I think that consciousness exists within everything, right on down to the subquantum level. And in fact, we wrote a paper, I and a professor emeritus at Texas A&M by the name of Ron Bryant.
Right.
Ryan wrote a paper together proposing an experiment to show or demonstrate that consciousness exists at the subquantum level. And if it does, then that would change the whole perspective on how reality works.
Okay, very quickly, Nogales, Arizona, I think you're on with Joe.
Okay, right now?
Yes, right now.
Okay. My name is Julia, and Art, first, I'd like to thank you so very much for coming back on the air.
Thank you.
You, throughout my lifetime, have just expanded my mind. As have you, Mr. McMonagle. I spoke to you about 10 years ago at a Gateway program.
Uh-huh.
And it's good. It's really good that you're still out there as well. All right, so I have a three-part question, and then I guess I'll take my answer off the air. First off, it has to do with, like, the limits of remote viewing. I think limits are important so that when we know what they are, we can transcend them and go beyond boundaries. So in the first one, there was a remote viewer on the unit named David Morehouse, and he came up with, he said that there was somebody that had developed a system that was an alarm system for remote viewers.
Okay, real quick, we're up on a break here. What's number three?
Okay, number three has to do with remote influencing. What is the jump from remote viewing to remote influencing?
All right. Well, you're certainly right on target. We've got to take a break right now, so hold tight, Joe, and we'll come right back to those three questions from the high desert. I'm Art Bell. This is Midnight in the Desert.
It is What's Next. To cast your ray of light into the darkness, please call 1-952. Call Art. That's 1-952-225-5278.
And if you've got Skype, you're welcome. In North America, it's MITD51. Outside North America, MITD55. Remote viewer, Joe McMonagle is our guest. Probably the world's best remote viewer. And an interesting time for you to be able to ask a question. Let's see, where in the world to go? Let's try a anonymous line here very quickly. You're on the air with Joe. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Sid in Edmonton.
Edmonton, okay.
I have a question. There was a class they did with remote viewers.
Right.
And their test to see this one thing, and it turned out with some sort of giant orb.
Oh, you're losing me a little now. You're saying they were trying to remote view some giant orb?
Yes, it was they didn't tell the class what it was.
Uh-huh.
And the whole class of remote viewers, you saw this giant orb, and it was some sort of giant alien consciousness.
Well, okay, I appreciate the question, but I'm not sure what we do with it. Joe's already said there is alien life out there. It would be pretty unusual for a whole class of trainees to see the same thing, Joe, wouldn't it?
Yeah, if it's truly a class of remote viewers. In many cases, some of the classes that are being taught, the viewers are not being kept totally ignorant of the target. In other words, the person teaching has access to the target and knows what the target is. And I hate to be a despoiler, but one of the problems is that human beings, 70% of our communications takes place nonverbally. So anybody in the room that knows what the target is communicating that information. They may not realize it, but they are in a lot of finite ways. And it's one of the reasons why we get a lot of commonality in viewings by groups. And group remote viewing is very hazardous for a number of reasons. One is, let's say you have eight viewers, and seven of the viewers say A, and the one viewer says B. There is just a statistical probability for viewer B to be correct as the others that are in agreement.
Interesting. All right, going back to the caller prior to the break, three quick answers, I hope, to three quick questions. Limits on remote viewing.
I don't know of any limits on remote viewing. We've tried to fix limits so that we could at least develop some kind of a defense mechanism against it, and we've never been able to fix a limit. So,
David Morehouse.
She said something about him mentioning an alarm or remote viewing alarm or something.
That's right.
I'm not familiar with anything that alarms to remote viewing. Certainly, if there was some reason that you would know that a remote viewing was taking place, that would be outstanding, like a strain gauge going off or something when a remote viewer was in the room.
Mm-hmm.
That, unfortunately, just doesn't happen.
My third question was concerning remote influencing, which we have already answered, and she can review on the program.
But, you know, there is one part of that that you have to say is influencing.
Oh?
If a viewer observe something, they're affecting it. They may not be affecting it physically.
Yes, I understand.
They are still observing it. So, in a sense, that is remote influencing.
Well, all right.
So I just wanted to correct myself on that part.
All right. Renee from San Jose, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Art. How are you?
I'm fine. You sound like a million miles away, though.
I apologize. I'm on Highway 5, driving down the road.
Oh, okay.
I have a question for your guest, Joe. Joe, you said you mentioned that you remote viewed them building the pyramids. Did you see how they moved those stones?
Okay, thank you. He's obviously in and out of cell service.
Yeah, the stones are moved by cart to a loading ramp and lowered into the boats using a crane. Basically a very simple wooden crane. The stones are then trucked to the building site down the Nile and into the lake, and then lowered into the lake. The lake water is used as an engineering plane, and they actually had alloyed saws that used water as a lubricant, water and sand as a lubricant.
Wow.
So that's how they cut the stones.
All right, let's... I'm sorry, go ahead.
The first third of the pyramid was done that way. The rest was done with smaller stones.
Okay. Red Oak, Texas, you're on with Joe. Hi.
Hi. I was going to ask, have y'all ever remote viewed like another dimension, a fourth dimension or something like that?
Oh, that's actually a very good question.
That is a good question, because I happen to think that what we're calling interactions with ETs or extraterrestrials, I don't think are interactions with extraterrestrials. I think many of the interactions that we're having have to do with interdimensional beings. I think there is a multiverse, probability for a multiverse, and that many of the things we're calling ET effects are actually interdimensional effects. They're able to open and shut doors to another universe and affect us in that way.
All right, very quickly on Skype, you're on the air with Joe McMonagle. Hi. Hello on Skype. Going once, going twice, gone. Hello there. Instead, you're on the air from somewhere in California. Hello?
That's right, Art.
Yes.
Art, you rapscallion. I've been patiently waiting for your return, my friend.
Thank you.
Joe, a big fan.
Yes.
I've tried some remote viewing via the course by Ed Dames, and I can say this stuff works. I'm a physicist, and this might sound a little self-serving, but I endeavor to win a Nobel Prize, and I'd like to use remote viewing to advance my understanding of some physical processes. Is this possible?
Using remote viewing, absolutely.
Yes.
We in fact, my friend Ron Bryan, he's a high energy physicist. He's a professor emeritus at Texas A&M. We did double blind targeting of subquantum particles, and the remote viewing was just as accurate as anything in the room size. And we were able to see things and describe things in the high energy arena, high energy ray arena that was consistent with some of the things caught by the fly array out in Arizona. So, you can use it for physics. And,
okay. All right. That's the answer. Short on time. Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hello.
Hi there. This is Kevin in Colorado Springs. I'm blind. And I've had some teachers tell me that I can't be a remote viewer. Now, I've had sight. I lost my sight later in life. So I'm wondering, I know I'd have to be describing what I see to someone, but is it possible for me to do remote viewing?
Absolutely. Remote viewing is a misnomer. You actually don't see something. It's perceptions. And the perceptions are, they come in many different ways, everything from sound to taste to feelings. And what my suggestion to you would be, as a person without sight, what you want to do is get some clay, and you want to model what you perceive with your fingers.
Uh-huh.
Because your not being sighted gives you an advantage in reality in that you're able to express yourself in extraordinary ways with touch.
That's remarkable.
And I suggest that you do that. I think you should take a remote viewing course and you should use your fingers and model with clay. Don't try to draw something or try to describe something that a sighted person would see.
What a neat way to approach it.
Model it.
Yeah, got it. Cam on Skype, you're on the air with Joe.
Hi. I like the modeling idea. Maybe.
Me too.
Mashed potatoes comes to mind, but I was curious. Recently, Courtney Brown, another remote viewer, released information about they looked into the Phoenix Lights, and I'm just curious if you know anything about that, or ever looked into that, or looked at, or followed what they looked into at all.
Sure.
No, I haven't looked at the Phoenix Lights. I actually do very little targeting on. What you could perceive as ETs or extraterrestrial or UFOs or things like that. The reason why is because one of my demands is if somebody brings me a target like that, I want them to almost guarantee that it is one of those peculiar sightings that fits the genre. If you look at 10,000 possible UFO sightings, probably 15 of them might be valid. And so when there's any question at all, I just assume not look at it.
Okay. I've got one quick one from the wormhole. That's what gives me messages. Jesus, have you remote viewed the concept of the things that occurred, the miracles that we've been told about with respect to Jesus and his time?
Yeah, I have, but not the miracles. I had an experience when I was in the lab at the Monroe Institute with Robert Monroe, and he had me strung out pretty well on his equipment using the hemisync signals.
Right.
And I had a perception that I was in the presence of a column of light, and he asked me to put my hand in it, which I did, and I was overwhelmed with the sense that, you know, that this is what the all-consuming love of Christ was. And it was a very overwhelming experience. I have no idea why I had it, other than it reinforced some things in my knowledge base, I guess. And it energized me to a certain extent. Okay. But that actually happened in the lab. But other than that, no, I've not been formally targeted on any of the miracles specifically.
All right.
That would be an interesting target, sir.
Sure would. All right, Debbie, you're on with Joe. Hi. Debbie, I'm...
Can you hear me okay?
I can, yes.
Okay, good evening, you guys. Hey, I've got a question, Joe. I'm wondering, at the beginning of the program, Art ran a commercial on a Capital, and it got me thinking about the dollar. And I'm wondering, have you remote viewed, the dollar, where our American dollar is going, you know, as the reserve currency of the world? Have you looked at that? And if so, what did you see?
Well, there's been some major moves to unseat the dollar as the world currency. And the problem they run into is that there are no other nations that that value their currency as the American dollar is valued. In other words, we have a system of valuation that seems to be rock hard, rock steady, even though we print money sometimes beyond our capacity to back.
Yes.
We still value it appropriately, even when it's drawn down in value. It's that system of valuation that's trusted, not necessarily the dollar.
Well, when times are troubled, people still run to the dollar. But
that's right.
You know that
because it's a secure currency, Art.
The best so far.
Yes, exactly. There just is no other value system that matches our value system, and that's why the dollar remains strong, even though it's we printed so many of them.
And if you look ahead, does it remain so?
Yes, I think it will. I think that China is coming into a crash. I think America is coming into a truly bull market. I think we're going to be seeing some incredible growth in the market area over the next 5 to 7 years.
All right, jumping to California, I think. Please turn whatever you've got off, please, or we're not going to be able to hear you.
Yeah, it's off. I was disconnected before, Art.
Sorry about that.
No problem. Am I live right now?
You are.
All right. Awesome. Joe, big fan. I've tried some of the remote viewing by the course, Ed Dames. I know he's not ranking high in this conversation this evening, but this stuff works. I'm a physicist, and it sounds self-serving, but I endeavor to win a Nobel Prize. And
okay, you told us all that, so go ahead.
Yeah. What I'd like to know is, can the remote viewing advance my understanding of some very technical physical processes? And if this is possible, what are your suggestions in reining in what Ed Dames refers to as that analytical overlay, that AOL, shutting off the thinking?
You're breaking up. Shutting off the thinking.
How do I shut off the AOL?
Okay. AOL. I don't know. You just hit disconnect. You're off AOL like that. I'm not exactly sure what he was talking about beyond that, are you?
He's talking about analytic overlay. It's when your ego becomes more involved with the process than the remote viewing, and you start inserting things that you want to hear or want to see. I think it's almost an impossibility in many cases. You have to know when to let go and put it down and walk away,
right?
And when to come back to it. And I do that quite frequently, and usually what I do is I'll carry a notebook in my shirt pocket, so when I'm cutting grass or doing some menial task somewhere, repairing a light switch or something, if I have something flash across my mind that's pertinent to the problem that I'm thinking about, I'll write it down. But if I find my thought process is getting involved, I usually put it down and walk away.
All right, Joe. The program is ending. I can't control it. We're out of time. I can't believe it. I could go on and on and on and on. So do you have a website? Anything you'd like to promote, do it.
Yeah, I'd really like to promote the Monroe Institute. I teach remote viewing here. It's one of the best places in the world to come learn about remote viewing, not just learning about monitoring, viewing, and analysis and that sort of thing, judging, but actually knowing when you walk away that you have actually remote viewed.
So in other words, if they're interested, Joe, they can get hold of the Monroe Institute and they can begin following up themselves.
Yes, it's monroeinstitute.org.
All right. Well, that certainly is the place. My friend, thank you so much for being here tonight. And I'm sorry we had so little time.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, it flew by.
It sure did. Thank you, my friend. Good night.
Thank you. You too.
From the high desert, the great American Southwest, to the world, good night, everybody. In the desert, I'm restless.